Hey everyone, welcome to the show. You know, it's amazing to think about how the little things we do every day, like our routines and habits, are actually shaped by, well, these much bigger forces in society. And that's what we're diving into today with this nonfiction history book, The Revolutionary Self, by Lynn Hunt. You can find the link to it in the description, by the way. Don't forget to like and subscribe while you're down there. This book really gets into how something as simple as, like, sharing a cup of tea could actually contribute to massive social and political changes.
Yeah, it's really fascinating. One of the most interesting things the book explores is this kind of paradox in the 1700s. This simultaneous rise of individualism, like people feeling unique and independent, at the same time as this growing awareness that society, like, really shapes who we are as individuals.
So it's like this constant tug of war, right, between wanting to be our own person and recognizing that we're also products of, well, everything around us.
Yeah.
So how does the book actually explore this tension?
Well, Hunt argues that this wasn't just some abstract philosophical debate happening in ivory towers. It played out in very real, practical ways. For example, she talks about how the rise of tea drinking, believe it or not, actually transformed social dynamics.
Tea time revolution. Okay, I'm all ears. Tell me more about how a simple cup of tea could be so, well, revolutionary.
So think about it. Before tea became popular, it was common for men to dine separately. But with tea drinking, suddenly everyone gathered around the table. And guess who was in charge of preparing and serving the tea? The highest ranking woman in the house, usually the mother or eldest daughter. So this brought a new level of visibility and, well, you could say agency to women within the family.
So it's not just about, you know, enjoying a new beverage. It's about creating a whole new social space where women could have a kind of a more central role. Did this actually lead to more real power for women, though, or was it more like symbolic?
That's a really great question. It's probably a bit of both, honestly. While tea drinking definitely provided a platform for women's voices, it wasn't like some magic wand that dismantled patriarchy, you know, but it did coincide with a growing awareness of women's rights and their contributions to society. Thinkers like John Miller, a Scottish law professor, even started arguing that the status of women was a key indicator of how civilized a society was.
Wow, that's a fascinating connection. So tea, in a way, kind of fueled these larger conversations about gender roles and social progress. That's really cool. But the book also talks about another surprising catalyst for this, like individual expression we were talking about. This incredible rise of a global pottery empire.
Yeah.
Tell me more about Josiah Wedgwood and how his story reflects the spirit of the time.
Oh yeah, Wedgwood. His story is a perfect example of what could happen when individual initiative met a changing social landscape. I mean, this guy wasn't just a skilled potter. He was like a marketing genius. He was innovating with new materials and techniques, and he created this brand that made his pottery desirable all over the world.
He sounds like the 1700s version of like a luxury brand today. What were some of the strategies he used that made him so successful?
Well, Wedgwood was really good at understanding his audience and tapping into like their aspirations. So he created beautiful functional pieces, yes, but he also marketed them as symbols of good taste and, you know, refinement. He even partnered with influential figures like the Queen of England herself to enhance his brand's prestige.
So he really understood it wasn't just about the product, it was about the image and the story you create around it. He sounds like this incredible mix of artist, entrepreneur, and social climber. But we can't talk about the 1700s without talking about the French Revolution. How does the book approach this massive, you know, tumultuous event?
It takes a really unique approach, actually. The Revolutionary Self focuses on the visual culture of the revolution, specifically all the prints that exploded during that time.
So we're not just talking about historical accounts, but about how people were visually representing and dealing with these huge social and political upheavals. What kind of messages were these prints putting out there?
They were much more than just depictions of events, you know? They were reflections of how people were beginning to understand society itself. These prints showed social interactions, the inequalities that existed, and how power dynamics were changing. It was like the very act of visualizing these complex issues forced people to think about society in new ways.
So it's almost like they were creating a new visual language for like understanding and criticizing the world around them. Did these prints actually directly impact the revolution? Do we know?
Well, it's hard to measure direct impact, of course, but it's undeniable they contributed to a growing sense of political awareness and public discourse. They were almost like an early form of mass media, spreading ideas and shaping public opinion. Some of them even used humor and satire to criticize those in power, which is pretty cool.
Oh, wow. I bet seeing these images all over the place was really powerful. It must have felt like a whole new way to engage with politics and social issues. The book even mentions specific prints, like one called I Knew We'd Have Our Turn. Are there any other particularly striking examples you remember that capture the spirit of the times?
Oh, yeah, definitely. There was one called They Only Wanted What Was Good for Us, which was super sarcastic. And then there was The Anarchist, I Fooled Both of Them, which really played on the political divisions of the era. And then you had, like, Poor Ruined Rentier Fish to Fry, which focused on economic anxieties, and Inside the Revolutionary Committee, which showed how power was shifting. What's interesting is how these prints went from simply portraying individuals to showing social interactions and inequalities, highlighting this growing awareness of how social forces actually worked.
It's just amazing to see how art can be such a powerful tool for social commentary and change. It seems like these prints really played a key role in how people understood the revolution and their own place within it. But amidst all this talk of revolutions and these big social forces, the book doesn't forget about the individual. In fact, it delves into the world of fashion as this surprisingly powerful reflection of both individual expression and societal change.
Yeah, that's right. Hunt really digs into how women's fashion especially became a battleground for expressing new ideas about femininity, freedom, and social values. And she highlights the work of female artists like Marie-Gabrielle Capet and Adelaide Labille-Guillard, who captured these shifts in their portraits.
So we're not just talking about, like, hemlines and trends, but about fashion as a form of social and political commentary. What were some of the big fashion statements of the era, and how did they reflect the changing times?
One of the most striking examples is the rise of the chemise dress. Now, it might not seem that shocking today, but back then, it was considered scandalous. The chemise was basically an undergarment, but women like Marie Antoinette started wearing them as dresses. It sparked a lot of controversy and symbolized this rejection of the rigid, you know, corseted styles of the past.
Wow. So it was like a fashion rebellion. They were saying, we're not going to be confined by these old rules and expectations. Mm-hmm. It's crazy to think something as simple as a dress could become a symbol of, like, broader social and political change.
Exactly. The chemise dress represented this yearning for simplicity, naturalness, and freedom of movement. It totally aligned with the ideals of the French Revolution, which emphasized equality and a rejection of these, like, extravagant displays of wealth.
It sounds like fashion became a way for women to visually show they were aligned with these revolutionary ideals. Did these fashion choices actually affect the course of events, or were they more symbolic?
It's tough to say for sure. But they definitely reflected a shift in attitudes and a growing sense of empowerment among women. And artists like Capet and Labille-Guillard played a key role in documenting and, you could say, amplifying these trends through their portraits.
I'm definitely curious to learn more about how these artists captured the spirit of the times through their work. But before we jump into that, let's take a quick break. We'll be back in a jiffy to continue our deep dive into the revolutionary self. All right, we're back, and I'm ready to hear more about these revolutionary artists you mentioned. Let's start with Marie-Gabrielle Capet. What makes her portrait so important when we're thinking about this book?
Well, Capet, she was really an interesting figure, you know, obviously a talented artist, but she was also deeply connected to the social and intellectual circles of the time. Her portraits, they weren't just about capturing what someone looked like. They were about conveying their personality, their social status. You could even say their inner life.
So she was capturing, like, not just the outside, but the spirit of the age itself. Could you give us an example of a portrait that really does that?
Absolutely. One of her most striking pieces is a portrait of the actress Mademoiselle Mars. Mars is depicted wearing this white muslin tunic, which, remember, we talked about how that became a symbol of simplicity, this nod to classical antiquity, you know, and rejecting the extravagant aristocratic fashion.
So even in her clothing, Mars is making a statement about her values and how she fits in with those revolutionary ideals. How does Capet actually show this through her style as an artist?
Well, her brushstrokes are very loose and fluid, which gives this feeling of movement and spontaneity. And the lighting, it's very soft and natural, highlighting Mars's youthful beauty and her gaze, which is very direct, exuding confidence and intelligence. It's a portrait that really captures both the individual and the spirit of the times.
It sounds like Capet was able to capture that essence of the revolutionary spirit, that mix of, like, personal expression and social awareness. What about Adelaide Labille-Guillard? How does her work fit into all this?
Oh, Labille-Guillard. She was another groundbreaking artist who challenged conventions. She was known for these large-scale historical paintings and her portraits of prominent women. One that really stands out is her self-portrait with two pupils.
A self-portrait with pupils. That's an interesting choice. What's the meaning behind that composition?
It's actually a very powerful statement about women's roles in the art world. At the time, women artists faced a lot of obstacles, like limited training and few opportunities to exhibit their work. So by painting herself alongside her pupils, LaBille Garrard is asserting her authority as a teacher and mentor, showcasing the talent and potential of women artists.
So it's a celebration of female creativity and a challenge to the kind of the male-dominated art world. Are there any other details in the painting that support that message?
Oh, absolutely. Notice how she positions herself in the painting. She's front and center, her eyes meeting the viewers directly, while her pupils are positioned a bit behind her. And she's dressed in this very elegant attire, her brush held confidently in her hand.
It's a powerful image of a woman in control of her art and her destiny. And it speaks to that larger idea of women claiming their space and their voices in a society that often tried to silence them. But the revolutionary self isn't all about art and fashion, right? It also gets into the realities of war and how the French Revolution transformed the military.
That's right. The revolution had a huge impact on how wars were fought. It led to these mass armies and a new emphasis on collective action, which really changed things for individual soldiers and how they saw their place in society.
Okay, so we're shifting gears from the salons of Paris to the battlefields of Europe. How did the revolution actually change the way armies were structured and how they fought?
Well, before the revolution, armies were mostly professional soldiers. You had clear divisions between ranks, and they relied heavily on traditional tactics. But the revolution brought this wave of volunteers, ordinary citizens, eager to defend their new republic.
Like a scene right out of Les Misérables. Did this influx of citizen soldiers create more chaos or a sense of unity?
It's hard to say, probably a bit of both. This flood of enthusiastic but often untrained soldiers forced military leaders to adapt. You have this tension between the ambition of individual soldiers, who were often eager to prove themselves, and the need to act collectively against a common enemy.
So a clash between individual heroism and the demands of, like, modern warfare, how did that play out on the battlefield?
It led to new battle formations, like using columns instead of traditional firing lines. These new formations required much more coordination and a different kind of discipline. It wasn't about standing in a line and firing anymore. It was about moving as one, charging with bayonets, relying on the strength of the group, not individual skill.
That sounds terrifying, but also kind of powerful. Did this shift towards mass armies and collective action change how soldiers viewed themselves and their place in society?
Oh, absolutely. It created this strong sense of camaraderie and shared purpose that went beyond social divisions. Soldiers, no matter their background, were fighting together, enduring the same hardships, working toward the same goal. It fostered a new kind of equality forged in the crucible of war.
So in a way, the battlefield became this melting pot, breaking down old hierarchies and creating a new sense of national identity. It's a powerful example of how extreme situations can really reshape how we see ourselves and our connection to others. Mm. But the revolutionary self doesn't just look at these big historical forces. It also zooms in on individuals who really embody the complexities of this era. And one figure who stands out is Étienne Clavier, this financial innovator who was a key player during the French Revolution.
Clavier, yeah. His story is fascinating. He was a self-made man, a true product of the Enlightenment. He believed in the power of reason and education to transform individuals and societies. And he really honed his financial skills in Geneva, a center of international trade and finance, where he quickly became known for his intellect and innovative thinking.
So he was kind of a financial prodigy. What were some of his early accomplishments that set him on the path to becoming such an important figure in the French Revolution?
He published these treatises on economics, developed new financial instruments, and even challenged the established practices of the French monarchy. He was particularly critical of how the government handled its debt, advocating for more transparency and a more responsible approach to spending.
Sounds like he was a real thorn in the side of the establishment.
Right.
But his outspokenness also shows a deep concern for, you know, the well-being of society. It wasn't just about making money. It was about using his financial knowledge to create a more just and fair system.
Precisely. Clavier's vision went beyond personal gain. He believed a well-managed economy could empower individuals, stimulate innovation, and ultimately lead to a more prosperous and enlightened society. He saw a direct connection between economic freedom and individual potential.
It's interesting how his story ties back to the main themes of the book. It's like he embodied that revolutionary spirit, that belief in the power of individuals to shape their own destinies and contribute to the greater good. But how did this financial reformer end up leading France's finances during one of the most chaotic periods in its history?
Well, his rise to political power was partly due to his collaboration with Jacques-Pierre Brissot, another reformer and a leading figure in the Girondin faction during the French Revolution.
Okay, so for those who aren't familiar with the different factions of the French Revolution, can you give us a little background on the Girondins?
Sure. The Girondins were a group of, moderate revolutionaries. They advocated for a constitutional republic and a more decentralized government. They were often at odds with the more radical Montagnards, who wanted a centralized state and more extreme measures.
So Clavier was aligning himself with a group that believed in a more, measured approach to revolution. What were some of the core values that he and Brissot shared?
They both had this passion for republican ideals, for greater political participation, and importantly, for the abolition of slavery. They saw slavery as both a moral abomination, an economic obstacle, believing a truly free and just society couldn't exist while that horrific practice continued.
That really shows their commitment to human rights and reminds us that the French Revolution wasn't just about political upheaval, it was about fundamental social change. Their efforts to create a more just society, both economically and socially, are quite inspiring. It's a reminder that even amidst chaos and uncertainty, individuals can make a difference by standing up for what they believe in. But I'm curious, how did Clavier's financial expertise actually come into play during the revolution? What were some of the main challenges he faced as France's finance minister?
Well, as you can imagine, being finance minister during a revolution was no walk in the park. He inherited a huge amount of debt, an empty treasury, and a completely messed up economy. And to top it all off, France was fighting a war that was draining its resources and putting immense pressure on its finances.
So basically, he was handed a ticking time bomb. What were some of the things he did to try and address these, monumental challenges?
One of his biggest moves was advocating for the creation of assignats, a type of paper money backed by the value of confiscated church lands. He thought this would help stabilize the economy, provide much-needed liquidity, and give regular citizens a stake in the revolution's success.
That sounds pretty bold. But didn't you mention earlier that the assignats ultimately failed? What went wrong there?
Well, the idea behind the assignats was good in theory, but putting it into practice was much harder. Counterfeiting became a big problem, inflation skyrocketed, and public confidence just eroded as the value of the assignats plummeted.
A classic example of how even the best plans can fall apart when you're dealing with unpredictable circumstances and, human nature. It really highlights that delicate balance between economic theory and the unpredictable reality of, how people actually behave. But before we get into the whole assignats thing, I'd love to hear about some of Clavier's other accomplishments as finance minister. Did he achieve any significant reforms during this crazy economic period? We're back and, ready to wrap up our deep dive into the revolutionary self. It's been a fascinating journey, exploring how these seemingly small things, actions and choices, can actually lead to these huge societal changes. We've sipped tea with revolutionaries, we've checked out Wedgwood's incredible marketing skills, and even found ourselves right in the middle of the French Revolution. But there's one more piece of the puzzle we need to look at. The story of Étienne Clavier, a man whose life really shows both the promise and the danger of those revolutionary times.
Yeah, Clavier's story really reminds us that progress, it's rarely a straight line. It's often messy, unpredictable, full of setbacks and compromises and things you just don't see coming.
Right, and we left off talking about how Clavier was facing more and more opposition from those more radical groups in the French government. How did he deal with that increasingly hostile political environment?
Well, he tried to stick to his principles, advocating for financial reforms that he thought would benefit the whole nation. But as things got more extreme, his more moderate stance was seen as a weakness by those who wanted more drastic action.
So he was stuck between a rock and a hard place, right?
Yeah.
Trying to make sensible reforms while also being pressured by those who saw any compromise as, a betrayal. Did he ever give up on his ideals, or did he change his approach to survive?
Clavier was a man of strong convictions. He believed in reason and economic justice, but he also knew when to be pragmatic. He tried to find some common ground with his opponents, but in the end, his efforts were just overwhelmed by this growing wave of extremism.
It's a classic problem for reformers, right? Trying to balance your ideals with the realities of power and politics. Did Clavier have any wins during this crazy time? Or was he just constantly fighting to stay afloat?
He did have some successes, despite the challenges. He made the financial administration more efficient, improved accounting practices, and made government spending more transparent. But his big goals, like setting up a national bank and changing the tax system, were constantly blocked by political opposition.
It sounds like he was always running into a wall. It must have been so frustrating to have such a clear vision for a better future, but be blocked at every turn by the people in power. Did he ever say he was disillusioned or regretted getting involved in the revolution?
In his personal writings, you can see moments of frustration and even despair. But he never lost faith in the revolution's principles. He believed France was moving towards a more just and fair society, even if the road was rough.
It shows his character that he stayed committed to his ideals even when things got really tough. But as we know, the French Revolution took a dark turn. What happened to Clavier?
As the Reign of Terror took hold, Clavier's moderate views and his connection to the Girondins made him a target. He was arrested, thrown in prison, and ultimately accused of treason.
So he became a victim of the very revolution he helped to create. It's a sad ending to a story that started with so much hope. How did he face his accusers, knowing what was coming?
People who were there said he faced them with dignity and calmness. He defended what he did, arguing that he always acted in the best interests of the nation, but nobody was listening. He was found guilty and sentenced to death.
It's heartbreaking, you know. It reminds us of the human cost of revolutions and how even the best intentions can go so wrong. What happened in his final moments? Did he express any regret or bitterness?
There are accounts that say he chose to take his own life rather than face the guillotine. It was like a final act of defiance, a way to control his own destiny when everything else was falling apart.
Tragic, but also really moving. A final act of control in a world that had gone mad. But even though his life was cut short, did his ideas and efforts have any impact on the French Revolution and what came after?
Absolutely. Clavier's ideas about economic fairness, transparency, and the government's role in promoting the common good continue to influence reformers in France and beyond. His focus on responsible financial policies and addressing inequality resonated with those who wanted to create a more just society.
So even in death, his vision for a better future continued. It's a good reminder that even the most chaotic times can give birth to ideas and movements that have a lasting impact. Before we finish our deep dive into the revolutionary self, let's go back to the book's main ideas about the tension between individual freedom and those larger social forces. How did Clavier's story reflect this paradox?
His life really embodies that tension. He was a strong advocate for individual freedom and economic freedom, but he also believed in collective action and the need for government to create a just and fair society. His story shows us how hard it is to find the right balance between these two forces.
And it's a challenge we still face today as we deal with globalization, technology, and how the individual relates to society. The revolutionary self gives us valuable insights into this ongoing human struggle, reminding us that creating a better future is something we have to do together. It requires both individual initiative and a shared commitment to the common good.
Well said. As we wrap up, I'm struck by how Clavier's story shows us that progress isn't always a smooth path. It's often two steps forward, one step back. But even with setbacks and tragedies, the human spirit's ability to innovate, to bounce back, and to strive for a more just world, it's truly inspiring.
It's a message that's really powerful, especially in times of uncertainty and change. Thanks for joining us on this deep dive into the revolutionary self. It's a book that makes us think critically about the things that shape our lives and the world around us. What stood out to you the most from all these examples? Let us know in the comments below, and be sure to share this episode with anyone who loves history or is interested in how powerful ideas can be. And as always, keep exploring, keep questioning, and keep diving deep into the world of knowledge and discovery.